Time now for hour number two of this weekend's big two-hour installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and the host of the program is Carol Marks. Here's Carol Marks now in conversation with Allison Lurie. Allison Lurie won the Pulitzer Prize in 1985 for her novel Foreign Affairs, and she's going to talk to Carol now about her latest book titled The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us, published by Delphinium Books.
Back in 1981, you wrote a book, The Language of Clothes, which really drew on your knowledge of both costumes and clothes. So now you have a new book, The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us. Is that a sequel, in a way, to The Language of Clothes? Because it discusses the fact that the architecture of homes has a language of its own, and it certainly is in words. So what is the language?
Well, there's more than one language. But it's perfectly true that that houses speak to us, and they speak for us. I was thinking about this in connection with your program because people... in the baby boomer generation, lots of them are changing homes now, or their houses are changing. Once your children move out, your house suddenly looks different. You have extra rooms you didn't have before. You have space. Maybe you have too much space, but you're going to move things around and maybe think about moving yourself and changing, therefore, what your house is going to say about you.
Very true. And you said that, you know, the houses that we live in now have an atmosphere, and the houses that if we move will also have an atmosphere, and that some people can recognize a house's atmosphere. And you said that when you were little, you could tell when you visited, in particular, two friends' houses, that they each had a different atmosphere, and that really, you know, made you feel differently about each of them.
That's absolutely true, but I think everyone does this, not just me. I think it's just that I've been trying to make this articulate and find out what it is that makes me feel good about somebody's house and what makes me feel bad about another house. And so I did a lot of interviews and talk to people about their own houses and other people's houses. And I discovered, for instance, that the windows are very important. If you go into a house and the very heavy curtains or blinds and you can't see out and nobody can see in, you get a feeling of being shut in, of people hiding from the world maybe, or not wanting to see what's outside. Of course, if what's outside is a rubbish dump, that's perfectly natural. But most people, if you look out your window, you'll see trees and grass and attractive buildings and people passing. So most of us want to be able to see out, but there are people who don't. And I think we're aware of this without quite understanding what's going on.
And today, the present popular style of architecture and has been, you know, these, and you talked about the fact that people are sometimes buying these big McMansions that they wanted several years ago, perhaps not to be as useful today because the children have left the nest, but they certainly have been very popular. And why do you think they have been so popular, and do people see any of the negative qualities that McMansions can have, which I never realized till you pointed out the fact about how they can change what you have on your next floor?
Yes, I think that's true. I think that a lot of people have dreamt of having a big, beautiful house, and if you look at a McMansion from a distance, it can give you that effect. But when you get inside, it's often very remarkable how little space there is, because you have this a great hall which goes up two stories. But what's happening there is that the bedroom that ought to be over the hall isn't there. So you're losing livable space in favor of impressive space. But impressive space isn't much fun after the first ooh and ah. It's just annoying that you have nowhere to put your overnight guests and your bedroom is small and cramped.
Very, very good point. Now, as you have said, architectural styles in houses and buildings come and go. And it got me to thinking about, you know, the simple ranch houses that I was kind of familiar with way back when. And I wonder if they'll come back because they're less expensive to build. They're easier being on only one floor, and that certainly would help us as our baby boomers, you know, grow and get older. It would be easier to get around in them.
That's absolutely true. And there are some very nice ranch houses. I've seen some that I'd be very happy to live in, but they were so popular that developers with low morals started building cheap, tacky versions one after the other. They were very inexpensive to put up because you didn't have to climb. You didn't have to build any scaffolding. So I think the nice ranch houses have been sort of upstaged by the many, many second-rate ones. And I think what will happen is the badly built ranch houses will collapse or be torn down, and some of the really nice ones will remain, and people will begin to like them again.
That's great news. And you also write about the fact that the interior of private homes reveals a lot about the people living there, including the furniture they have and how it's placed, and why is this, and can you tell us what that has to do with the furniture?
Well, you know, it's not only the furniture you get, it's what you do with it. I mean, you can buy the same chairs and sofa and tables and put them in your sitting room in such a way that you can sit and talk intimately to someone. The chairs are close together, or one is pulled up near to the sofa. Or you can read because there's a table with a good lamp on it. Or you can place them so that all you can really do is sit in a row and watch a huge screen television. And once you walk into this room, you'll know whether people do anything there except watch television, whether they do sit next to each other and talk intimately and feel comfortable and read a good book. So it's not so much the furniture itself. It's what you do with it.
You know, and every time I go into a room or a house now, I'm going to pay attention to a lot more details. Now, in your book, you talk about the difference in architecture between hard and soft architecture, and the piece of architecture that you mention, as all hard architecture has, it makes it difficult for humans to have any kind of impact in it. And my favorite hated hard architecture is the airport terminal. Do you agree with that? That's
horrible. I absolutely do. I don't know why airports want people to be so uncomfortable unless it's to force them into the airport lounges, the airline lounges, because you go into one of these airline lounges, and that's what an airport ought to look like. It's the comfortable places to sit. You can get a cup of tea. You have a place to put your suitcase. But instead, unless you're willing to pay these quite high fees, you're going to be marooned on a row of hard chairs with hard armrests between them. They're not there so you can rest your arm. They're there so you can't lie down. And you see people slumped in these uncomfortable positions when their flight is canceled. I'm amazed that the airports can get away with it. It's so disagreeable.
I think we somehow have to rise up against it. It can be another cause.
Yes.
And the buildings that are called soft, beauty parlors, hospitals, and churches, they're trying to get positive feelings from the people who use them, and they have good feelings.
Yes, that's true. I think that all buildings like that, they want us to feel relaxed, to feel safe, to feel warm and comfortable, and so they go for soft architecture, for pleasant furniture, and I think that, of course, that's not true of some buildings. They don't get it right, and I think that's because a lot of architects are interested in buildings as sculpture. They love the way it looks from outside, but they don't care as much about the people who are going to use it and how comfortable they'll be inside.
You're so right with all those windows that don't open and all those other little problems. Now, in writing about the ways in which any building, house, or even a room can tell us about the people who live there, I know you did so much research, wonderful research for the book. Was there a particular piece of information you learned that surprised you about the way architecture design is both a mirror and a molder of our experiences?
Well, I think I've always known that unconsciously, because the things we bring into our houses represent the lives we've lived. Anyone who walked into my house, for instance, would know that there was some connection with India, because my husband has had three trips to India. He was teaching there on a Fulbright a couple of times, and so he's brought back pictures and little statues, and anybody who could look around and say, there's some connection here. You also, of course, have people whose families come from India, and they will have these same things, but they'll perhaps have more of them, and they'll have a more personal connection to them.
That's Allison Lurie in conversation with Carol Marks. Her book is titled The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us. It's published by Delphinium Books. Coming up next, we'll be joined by our senior correspondent Richard Neer in conversation with Daniel James Brown, talking about his new book, The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. That's next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here now for the rest of this hour, we're being joined by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. He's in conversation with Daniel James Brown. Daniel James Brown has taught writing at San Jose State University and Stanford. He's going to talk to Richard about his new book titled The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics, published by Penguin.
Daniel, we know Jesse Owens, we know Marty Glickman's story, we know Louis Zamperini's story from the 36 Olympics. How did you stumble on this story about the boys in the boat?
This story literally walked into my house one day about 6 years ago. One of my neighbors came over, and she told me that she'd been reading one of my earlier books to her father, and her dad was in hospice care in the last couple months of his life, but living at her home, and she asked if I would come down to meet him. And so it was the next day, I think, I went down, and I met this elderly gentleman named Joe Rance. And Joe was on oxygen, and he was very weak, but he was very alert mentally. And we talked for a minute about that earlier book, but then he began to talk about his experience growing up during the Depression, and he had a particularly poignant story to tell about his family circumstances and how he overcame them as a teenager and a young man. And then he began to talk about how he'd begun to row on the crew at the University of Washington starting in the fall of 1933, and how that had begun to redeem his life in some senses, and how ultimately he and his crewmates had wound up rowing for an Olympic gold medal against a German boat, amongst others, in Berlin in 1936, in front of Hitler and Goebbels and all the other top Nazis. And so as he told me this story, I was just absolutely mesmerized. I couldn't believe it. And at the end of the story, I asked him, I said, I hadn't gone down there intending to try to find a book topic, but I was so drawn in by it, I just said, Joe, can I write a book about your life? And he immediately shook his head and looked down the floor and said, no, I don't want you to write a book about me. But then he looked up and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, but you could write a book about the boat. And at first I didn't know what he meant. I thought he meant this beautiful cedar racing shell that they had rowed in. And then I realized suddenly that by the boat he meant the other boys in the boat, of course. But he really meant more than that, even sort of this this almost perfect thing that all of them had become, you know, that beautiful afternoon in Berlin 75 years before. And so that's the spirit. I started the next day, and that was the spirit in which I wrote the book. I wanted to keep true to through the writing of it.
Now, were there other survivors that you were able to contact, or did you mostly have to rely on these stories from their descendants?
Well, when I started, only Joe and one other fellow, Roger Morris, were still alive. And so, of course, I talked to them as much as I could. But within a year, both of them were gone. Fortunately, when the family members of all nine guys in the boat, eight oarsmen and a coxswain, when they found out what I was up to, these families had been sitting on this story for 75 years, just hoping somebody would write it. So they came to me with boxes of letters and diaries and photos and news clippings. And more importantly, they sat down with me for, gosh, probably a couple hundred hours worth of interviews, talking about their dad or their granddad, as the case might be. And so it was through that very long, elaborate process of talking to them and looking at their notes that we were able to reconstruct the lives of all nine of them. And that was enormously interesting and enormously fun for me, and I think it's been very gratifying for them all to see the story finally told.
And so much it is about growing up in the Depression, and the interesting thing, I mean, we've seen comparisons to Seabiscuit, but, you know, horse racing, boxing were big sports back then, not so much now. What about crew? Was rowing a major deal back then, or was it sort of the small sport that it seems to be in this day and age?
To my astonishment, I've discovered this sport, that crew was an enormously popular sport in the 1920s and 30s, especially. I had no idea when I started this, but I quickly found out that in those days, 100,000 people would turn out for regattas regularly, and not just in Boston or someplace like that, but all in cities all across the country, wherever there was water. Major prominent oarsmen were featured on the covers of national magazines. Major races were carried live coast to coast on radio, which was then a new medium, and millions of people would tune in to listen to these races. And in fact, at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, the rowing regatta was the second biggest venue in terms of crowds, following only the track and field events in the big Olympic stadium there. So it was enormously popular, and it's a little hard to get your mind around these days because, very few people follow crew these days, but average Americans were very interested in the 1930s.
And it is really the ultimate team sport in that every rower has to give up their own stardom, their own ego, and basically do everything for the team, and I imagine that's part of the reason why these guys stayed so close together up until their deaths.
Yeah, I mean, crew is all about climbing in a boat together and becoming part of something larger than yourself. It's all about subsuming the ego and pulling hard, not just for yourself, but for everybody else in the boat. It's a fascinating sport for that very reason. It requires a degree of collaboration, both physically and mentally, that I'm not sure I can think of anything else in sports or life, in fact, that requires quite that degree of teamwork and bonding and coming together to be really successful at it. And, in fact, that's a big part of what the book is about. In many ways, I see this book as a sort of a metaphor. These nine kids, ordinary American kids, who climbed in a boat and learned to pull together so powerfully and so beautifully, I've come to see them as sort of a metaphor for what that whole generation of Americans, the generation who found themselves in the same boat during the Depression, they learned to come together, to pull together, to get great things done, to build great teams, to win World War II, build the Grand Coulee Dam, to build the most prosperous era in our history. So, as I say, that's really fundamentally underneath it all what the book's all about is building teams, building trust, and getting great things done.
Well, let's talk about building the boat. I mean, now technology, we know about the America's Cup and how sophisticated it is and all the computer models that they use. You mentioned before it was a cedar boat. How were those constructed?
You know, they're really almost works of art as much as they are functional rowing machines. The crew here at University of Washington was very lucky in that they had, in the same building as the crew house, was the workshop of George Pocock, who by the mid-1930s was the master craftsman of rowing shells anywhere in the world, certainly anywhere in the United States. He was really an artist with cedar. And he built these boats out of Western red cedar, the native tree here in the Northwest. And they're just exquisite to look at, but they also, in the mid-1930s, were absolutely state-of-the-art, and every crew program in the country wanted a Pocock shell by the mid-1930s. So in addition to being a great boat builder, Pocock was also an extremely good oarsman, and he taught these kids to approach rowing almost the way he approached the building of these boats, as a kind of craft that they needed to put their hearts into. And that had a huge effect on a lot of these kids and helped make them what they were, I think, in the long run.
Well, we know that there's a motion picture of Unbroken coming out, directed by Angelina Jolie, very soon. What are the chances that Boys in the Boat makes the silver screen?
Well, I think the chances are pretty good, actually. The Weinstein Company, which is the company that made The King's Speech and a number of other Oscar-winning films in the last few years, has first they optioned and then they bought the film rights to the book. And I know they're working on a script. I don't know how far along they are with that, but the signs are pretty good that they, in fact, will come to the silver screen.
That's Daniel James Brown in conversation with Richard Neer. His book is titled The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics, published by Penguin. I'm Michael Harrison. Richard Neer returns for more conversation when A Touch of Gray continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Engines.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we continue to be regaled by Richard Neer, our senior correspondent, who just moments from now will be doing his second interview of this hour, talking with Ray Fournier, a 71-year-old Oneida Nation member who won the national powerlifting title and qualified for the international championship. He's going to share with Richard his inspirational story on how he stays active and fit. Actually, Richard already knows the story because the conversation was recorded and will have its world debut here on A Touch of Gray in about 5 or 6 minutes from now. So, Richard, isn't it fascinating when you talk to these people in their 70s and beyond who have tremendous athletic accomplishments under their belt in modern times? In other words, not back when they were 30, but now? It's just marvelously inspiring.
And so many take it up late in life, you know, and it just goes to the message, I think, of the whole program, is that it's never too late. If you've had interest, if you've always wanted to do something, now maybe you're retired, maybe you have a little bit more time on your hands, or you're kind of thinking about your life and what you wanted to do versus what you did, you've got the opportunity to kind of reinvent yourself in a lot of ways.
Time really is the factor. I think the thing that stands between people and being in shape, eating correctly, doing exercise, having a variety of interests that give you a mental balance, I think that the pressures of the clock, the pacing of our lives, the lack of time or the perception that we don't have time is what keeps people on the unhealthy side of the track. That's what I think.
Well, I think it's not necessarily a lack of time. I'll disagree with you. I think it's a lack of priorities. You know, there are so many hours in the day, and if you make it a point to allocate 20 minutes, 30 minutes to your personal fitness, working out, walking, doing whatever, you can find that time, time that you might spend idly, you know, going through the internet or reading gossip on the internet or, you know, reading a newspaper or watching a mindless TV show, you know, what you do to decompress. You have to really consciously, though, prioritize doing the things as opposed to just let things drift.
You make a good point, and I see it, and I agree. Adding on to that, I would say that the key then is to figure out a way to like doing the exercise. In other words, it's fun to sit and watch a mindless piece of television trash at the end of a hard day or, you know, when you're on the weekend when you want to relax. It's easy to get caught up reading and surfing the internet and going from thing to thing, and it's kind of fun sometimes, and you find yourself, oh my gosh, I've been sitting here online for the last hour and a half, I've accomplished nothing, but I've been reading all kinds of stuff. And yet the idea of running around the block or going to the gym is not always appealing.
Here's a way around that, and it's pretty easy. It's multitasking, which of course we've knocked in the show before. But how about have your TV and have a Stairmaster or stair climber or recumbent bicycle or something that you can wheel in front of that, and while you're watching that mindless stuff, just be mindlessly pedaling away or jogging away for a half hour while you're watching the show, and zip, you've accomplished two things at once, and you really didn't have to think a lot about the treadmill or the recumbent bike, but you were able to do what you wanted to do.
Have you ever done that? Because I've tried that, and I find it takes away from my it takes away from the fun of watching. It gets in the way of concentrating.
Well, you have to get to a point where you're just repeating this exercise without thinking about it, you know, pedaling or running or whatever. You don't think about that. You just do it, and you absorb yourself into whatever you're watching or reading.
See, my wife is addicted to exercise. She actually is physically and emotionally addicted to it and loves it. It's you know, it's like I speak, you know, I'm from Mars and she's from Venus when it comes to this subject, because I understand the benefits of exercise, but I can never say that I've loved exercise unless it's like getting together with your friends and having a softball game. You know, that's kind of fun if it's a game. But going out solo exercise has never been something that I've been able to convince myself is meditative or gives you a chance to get in touch with your thoughts or blows off unwanted poisons and toxins and energy. Mm-hmm. I just find it extremely boring and stressful. But she, on the other hand, absolutely loves it and gets crazy if she can't do it.
Well, how about trying to do it with her? The fittest I've ever been in my life is well, I mean, she'll slow down.
No, she won't.
Stay with it. Well, all right, so you trail behind her. But the fittest I've ever been in my life was when I had a friend of mine who was living in the same house for a while through weird circumstances, and we'd run every night. And it was great. We'd look forward. We could talk while we were running. We bonded and all of that. And we both were in great shape then.
Yeah, I've had that experience too. And I have done 10Ks, and I have been at times in my life where I've been fit. I'm not in such a time at the moment. I do hope to get back to it. That's why I found this whole thing fascinating, talking about a 71-year-old gentleman who is going strong and building his body and winning awards. We will listen to that conversation next. And then, Richard, I'd like to talk a little bit about pop culture with you and some of the happenings of the past week when that interview is completed. We're talking with Richard Neer, our senior correspondent. I'm Michael Harrison. And A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
www.socialsecurity.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again, as promised, is our senior correspondent Richard Neer in conversation with Ray Fournier. He's a 71-year-old Oneida Nation member who won the national powerlifting title and qualified for the international championship. He's going to share with Richard his inspirational story on how he stays active and fit.
Tell us about national powerlifting and at your age, how you're able to achieve such a lofty goal. Is it divided into age categories, or is it just wide open to anybody of any age?
Well, you have various categories. Anybody can lift, do powerlifting. I mean, anyone from male, female, age from, you know, teens up to 90s. And also there's people that are involved in special needs. So you get a variety of different people. I got involved with powerlifting quite by accident, actually. I was lifting in a gym down in Tennessee, and it was a tourist area, and there were people that come in and out of that gym quite a bit. And a man approached me and saw me lifting and said, hey, you ought to try powerlifting. He was a former powerlifter himself, but retired, and he thought I could do pretty well. So I said, at first I said, no, I don't particularly want to. I'm not interested. And he said, well, you ought to think about it. It may be different than what you think it is. And I checked it out, and of course, gone from there. I started out with a state champion in Tennessee last March, and then again this March, and it's gone on from there.
Is there a lot of competition in that Master 4A division, that age group that you're in? Are there a lot of powerlifters across the country who compete?
No, there. As you get up in age, the number of powerlifters in your division goes down, it dwindles. And so you don't have a lot, but certainly on a national and international level, you do.
Well, I have to ask you this because you're obviously very aware of the whole steroid situation in baseball, and a lot of people say, well, it came from powerlifting, it came from weightlifting. People were into that, and, you know, they had great success, and it spread to baseball, and it's obviously in football and other sports as well. Was that part of the culture? Did you see any of that, or at the point that you joined, it was pretty much cleaned up?
I wouldn't have joined if I suspected that there was any of that kind of drug use in the sport. The powerlifting that I lift in is called Raw. It's a USAPL, which is a drug-free. They test, they do random tests for drugs and steroids and all kinds of things. So it's pretty well cleaned up. Of course, there are always violators, and that's why they test, and that's why they ban some people from it.
Now, you grew up in the Oneida Nation, and my parents had a place on Oneida Lake for a lot of years in Sylvan Beach. My brother owns it now. They go up there quite frequently.
Really?
And your nation has been at the forefront, I think, of the protest with the Washington football team. And I do a sports talk show in New York, and I get a lot of people who say, you know, it's tradition, it's not offensive, it's not a problem, why should we change our name just because a few people are upset about it? Give us your perspective on this and why this name should be changed and why it is offensive.
Well, first of all, racial bias, cultural bias usually has to do with the color of one's skin. And when, you know, the first people that came to the New World came in contact with us, of course, they called us Redskins, and of course, it was a very derogatory term, and of course, it's you know, it's stuck on, and I think we're at an age where, at a time in the 21st century here, well, we need to get rid of those kinds of things. So, the whole Redskins kind of approach to you know, naming their team is certainly derogatory to the Indian people, and we really should be more aware of that and cognizant of it, and try to avoid those kinds of things at this stage in our history.
Yeah, and I also get calls from people who say, well, how many people, you know, we've done surveys, and people in the Indian nations are, by and large, are not offended. And my point coming back to them were, well, if anybody's offended, why would you do that? Why would you deliberately offend even a small minority of people when you could choose not to? And people just don't seem to understand that.
Well, you're saying a small minority of people. It's not a small minority of American Indian people that are.
Well, that's what they say. They say, oh, it's only 20% from some surveys. But I question the methodology of those surveys, don't you?
I certainly do, and I question whether they really were able to get a hold of Indian people. There's such a small population of Indian people in this country now. I just wonder how well they were able to survey that. I would question the survey technique, yes.
And the point I always try to make is, if you saw a Native American at a bar and you walked up to him and said, "Hey, Redskin, what do you think the reaction would be?" And everybody says, they don't have an answer for it. And I think that's the proof in the pudding that it is an offensive term.
Absolutely, I agree with you on that 100%.
Well, Ray, I thank you so much for joining us. Good luck. Are you going now? Where would the international competition be? Where was this going to be held?
The international competition for next year will be in Helsinki, Finland. I just attended the international event in South Africa this past June. So next year, I had to requalify to represent the United States team in Helsinki, and I did that in Denver this past July.
Ray Fournier, in conversation with Richard Neer, on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and as promised, Richard Neer rejoins us. Interesting conversation with Ray Fournier, as promised, and he is back. Richard, I had mentioned earlier that in the final segment of our conversation, we're going to talk a little bit about popular culture. And I have to tell you, earlier in the show, in the first hour, I was talking with Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine about Joan Rivers, and Joan Rivers, who tragically died, woman in her 80s, but she seemed to have been in pretty good health. It wasn't that she died from any kind of a disease. It's elective surgery, and she had what's considered to be a routine procedure. And so not only are we talking about the iconic Joan Rivers, who obviously was quite a big presence on the American popular culture scene, more so than I even realized, and I knew her. But also this whole conversation about healthcare and changes in healthcare, that this topic, just like Robin Williams triggered depression and suicide, the Joan Rivers untimely death has triggered a tremendous amount of evaluation about how safe is it today in the healthcare system to have any type of surgery.
Well, you hear so much about outpatient procedures that, well, back in the day you had to stay in the hospital for 2 or 3 days, and now you can have it done in a doctor's office and go home. And yes, you can, and yes, it is more cost-effective, but the problem is, if you do something, and apparently there was a biopsy taken, it was an additional procedure that really wasn't scheduled, and the clinic may not have had the equipment needed to perform this safely, and it cut off her air supply, and that's why she died. At least that's what's been written so far. So, If she was in a hospital, would she have survived? Would she have, they had the necessary equipment and she would have been all right? So in our quest to cut healthcare costs, streamline things, save money, we're also putting ourselves a little bit more at risk, aren't we?
Yes. People don't realize, and I'm certainly not trying to spread fear, but certainly caution is important, that there's no such thing as, you know, minor surgery. There's major surgery and then really major surgery. You sign a form, if you read the fine print, even to have your tonsils taken out, or that you could die.
Oh, well, I'm about to have a tooth extracted, and the dentist, well, do you want us to knock you out? And this comes right after the Joan Rivers thing, and I'm thinking, you know what, I don't think I want to be knocked out, because I've seen so many times, and this is minor tooth extraction, but see how many times where people just don't wake up.
Mm-hmm.
It happened apparently to Rick Sklar, the famous program director of WABC in New York.
Yeah, I think he was having a foot surgery,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he died. And that was a terrible shock. You know, it's interesting, anesthesiology is a fascinating field. Now, I have been reading a lot about it lately because I have, as you know, I'm very interested in consciousness. I'm very interested in some of these quantum physics, metaphysical. These are areas that interest me. I'm not a wackadoo. I'm not like out there in Mars. I enjoy that aspect of parapsychology and psychology, where science and science fiction meet. And consciousness, human consciousness, is a very interesting topic. And when you go under anesthesia, you are messing with your consciousness. You really are. It's a very profound thing that requires tremendous specialization. And a lot of people just think, oh, they knock you out and you wake up.
Well, the weirdest thing is when they don't totally knock you out, they give you this thing called Versed, where it's called twilight sleep, where you're actually talking, you're conscious, but you don't remember any of it.
Yeah.
It's just wiped out.
Which is a whole other topic. Let's save that for another time, the impact of memory on what we think is real. Richard Neer, I go in so many directions with you. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Senior correspondent on our program. We thank you very much. Beverly Sandinello, our producer on the front line, pulling it all together. Thank you, Kevin Casey. Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Thank you to the entire Touch of Grey team, headed by Carol Marks, our host. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.